Michelle stood, went to the mirror. There is a thing called body dysmorphic disorder, he said. It's related to obsessive-compulsive disorders and to depression. I've noticed signs of it in you for a long time now.
It's my birthday.
Ah, well, it's a treatable problem.
Birthdays?
Body dysmorphic disorder. I won't take drugs. He put a towel over the mirror, turned to look at her.
What do you mean?
It may be a simple lack of serotonin, a biochemical insufficiency, a disease, nothing to be ashamed of in that. We all take drugs. Clomipramine is very helpful for this problem.
I'll think about it.
And no mirrors.
I'm not a child, she snarled. I know what I look like.
She leaped up and tore the towel off the mirror. Insane reptile vulture, pterodactylic, ferocious. It was impressive, in a way. Michelle shrugged. He had a little smile on his face, which she wanted to punch or kiss. He liked lizards. She shook her head to clear it.
Well, take action, you say?
She thought about it.
I certainly prefer action to the alternative in the current situation we're in.
She told him about the news from the South and her proposal to the others.
They make me so angry. They're just waiting for disaster to strike again, all but Sachs, and he's a loose cannon with all his sabotages, consulting with no one but these fools he has. We have to do something coordinated.
Good, he said emphatically. I agree. We need this. She regarded him.
Will you come to Hellas Basin with me?
And he smiled, a spontaneous grin of pure pleasure, of delight that she had asked. It pierced her heart to see it.
Yes, he said.
I have some business to finish here, but I can do that quickly, just a few weeks. And he smiled again. He loved her, she saw, not just as a friend or therapist, but as a lover, too. And yet, with a certain kind of distance, a Michelle distance, some kind of therapist thing, so that she could still breathe, be loved and still breathe, still have a friend.
So you can still stand to be with me, even though I look like this?
Oh, Maya, he laughed. Yes, you are still beautiful, if you want to know. Which you still do, thank God. He gave her a hug, pulled back and inspected her. It is a trifle austere, but it will do. She pushed him away.
And no one will recognize me.
No one who doesn't know you. He stood. Come on, are you hungry?
Yes, let me change clothes.
He sat on the bed and watched her as she did, soaking her up, the old goat. Her body was still a human body, amazingly enough, demonstrably female even at this ridiculous posthumous age. She could walk over and squash a breast into his face, and he would suckle it like a child. Instead, she dressed, feeling her spirit scrape off the bottom and begin their rise. The best moment in the whole sine wave, like the winter solstice for the Paleolithics. The moment of relief when you know the sun will come back again, some day. This is good, Michelle said. We need you to lead again, Maya. You have the authority, you see, the natural authority. And it's good to spread the work around and for you to concentrate on Hellas. A very good plan. But you know, it will take more than anger. She pulled a sweater over her head. Her scalp felt funny, bare and raw. Then looked at him, surprised. He raised a finger admonishingly.
Your anger will help, but it can't be everything. Frank was nothing but anger, remember?
And you see where it got him. You have to fight not only against what you hate, but for what you love, you see. And so you have to find what it is you love. You have to remember it or create it.
Yes, yes, she said, suddenly irritated. I love you, but shut up now. She lifted her chin imperiously. Let's go eat.
The train from Sabishi out to the Burroughs Hellas Piste was only 4 cars long, a little locomotive and 3 passenger cars, none more than half full. Maya walked through them to the last seats of the final car. People glanced at her, but only briefly. No one seemed perturbed by her lack of hair. There were a lot of vulture women on Mars, after all, even some on this very train, also wearing work jumpers of cobalt or rust or light green, also old and UV-weathered, a kind of cliché. The ancient Mars veterans, here from the beginning, seen it all, ready to bore you to tears with tales of dust storms and stuck lock doors. Well, it was just as well. It wouldn't have done to have people nudging each other and exclaiming, "There's Toitovna!" Still, she couldn't help sitting down feeling ugly and forgotten, which was stupid. She needed to be forgotten, and ugliness helped that. The world wants to forget the ugly. She plumped into her seat and stared forward. Apparently, Sabishi had been visited by a contingent of Terran Japanese tourists, all of them clustered in facing seats at the front of the car, chattering and looking around with their vid spectacles, no doubt recording every minute of their life movies, recordings that no one would ever watch. The train slid gently forward, and they were off. Sabishi was still a small tent town in the hills, but the hummocky land between the town and the main piste was studded with carved peak boulders and small shelters cut into the cliffs. All north-facing slopes were caked with the snow of the autumn's first storms, and the sun bounced in blinding flashes off slick mirrors of ice as they floated by frozen ponds. The low, dark shrubs were all based on ancestors from Hokkaido, and the vegetation gave the land a spiky black-green texture. It was a collection of bonsai gardens, each of them an island separated by a harsh sea of broken rock. The Japanese tourists naturally found this landscape enchanting, although possibly they were from Burroughs, new emigrants down to visit the Japanese first landing site, as if making a trip from Tokyo to Kyoto. Or perhaps they were natives and had never seen Japan. She would be able to tell when she saw them walk, but it didn't matter. The piste ran just north of Jarry des Loges crater, which from outside appeared to be a big round mesa. The apron was a broad fan of snowy debris, dotted with ground-hugging trees and a piebald array of dark greens and bright lichen and alpine flowers and heather, each species with its signature color, and the whole field starred by the scattering of erratic boulders that had fallen back from the sky when the crater was formed. The effect was of a field of red rock being drowned from below by a rainbow tide. Maya stared out at the vivid hillside, feeling mildly stunned. Snow, lichen, heather, pine. She knew that things had changed in the world while she had hidden under the polar cap, that before it had been different, and she had lived in a rock world and had experienced all the intense events of those years, had had her heart smashed to stishovite under their impact. But it was so hard to connect with any of that, either to remember it or to feel anything about what she could remember. She sat back in her seat and closed her eyes and tried to relax, to let whatever would come to her come. It wasn't so much a specific memory of a specific event, but rather a kind of composite. Frank Chalmers angrily denouncing or deriding or fulminating. Michelle was right. Frank had been an angry man, and yet that wasn't all he had been. She more than anyone knew that, perhaps, had seen him at peace, or if not at peace, perhaps she had never seen that, at least happy, or something like that. Scared of her, solicitous of her, in love with her. She had seen all that. and shouting at her furiously for some small treachery, or for nothing at all, she had certainly seen that too, because he had loved her. But what had he been like, really? Or rather, why had he been that way? Was there ever any explaining why they were themselves? There was so little she knew about him before they had met. A whole life back there in America, an incarnation that she hadn't seen. The bulky, dark man she had met in Antarctica. Even that person was almost lost to her, overlaid by everything that had happened on the Ares and on Mars. But before that, nothing, or next to nothing. He had headed NASA, got the Mars program off the ground, no doubt with the same corrosive style he had exhibited in later years. He had been married briefly, or so she seemed to recall. What had that been like? Poor woman. Maya smiled. But then she heard Marina's voice again saying, "If Frank hadn't killed John..." And she shuddered. She stared at the lectern in her lap. The Japanese passengers at the front of the car were singing a song, a drinking song, apparently, as they had a flask out and were passing it around. Jarry Desloges was behind them now, and they were gliding along the northern rim of the Iapygia Sink, an oval depression that they could see a fair way across before the horizon cut it off. The depression was saturated with craters, and now inside each ring was a slightly separate ecology. It was like looking down into a bombed florist's shop, the baskets scattered everywhere and mostly broken, but here a basket of yellow tapestry, there of pink palimpsest, of whitish or bluish or green Persian carpets. She tapped on her lectern and typed out, "Chalmers." It was an immense bibliography. Articles, interviews, videos, books, a whole library of his communiques to Earth, another library of commentaries, diplomatic, historical, biographical, psychological, psychobiographical, histories, comedies, and tragedies, in every medium, including, apparently, an opera. Meaning some villainous coloratura was down there on Earth, singing her thoughts. She clicked off the lectern, appalled. After a few minutes of deep breathing, she clicked it back on and called up the file. She couldn't bear to look at any video or still images. She went for the shortest biographical articles in print from popular magazines and called one up at random and began to read. He was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1976 and grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. His mother and father divorced when he was 7, and after that he lived mostly with his father, in apartments near Jacksonville Beach, an area of cheap stucco beach property built in the 1940s, behind an aging boardwalk of shrimp shacks and hamburger joints. Sometimes he lived with an aunt and uncle near the downtown, which was dominated by big skyscrapers built by insurance companies. His mother moved to Iowa when he was 8. His father joined Alcoholics Anonymous 3 separate times. He was his high school's class president and the captain of its football team, on which he played center, and of its baseball team, on which he played catcher. He led a project to clear the choking hyacinths from the St. John's River. His entry in his senior yearbook is so long you just know something had to be wrong. He was accepted by Harvard and given a scholarship. Then, after 1 year, transferred to MIT, where he earned degrees in engineering and astronomy. For 4 years, he lived alone in a room above a garage in Cambridge, and very little information about him survived. Few people seemed to have known him. He went through Boston like a ghost. After college, he took a National Service Corps job in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and here was where he burst onto the national scene. He ran one of the most successful civilian works programs associated with the NSC, building housing for Caribbean immigrants coming through Pensacola. Here, thousands of people knew him, at least in his work life. They all agree he was an inspirational leader, dedicated to the immigrants, working nonstop to help their integration into American society. It was in these years that he married Priscilla Jones, the beautiful daughter of a prominent Pensacola family. People spoke of a political career. He was on top of the world.
Then in 2004, the NSC was terminated, and in 2005, he joined the astronaut program in Huntsville, Alabama. His marriage broke up that same year. In 2007, he became an astronaut and moved quickly into a flying administration post. One of his longest space flights was 6 weeks on the American Space Station, alone with fellow rising star John Boone. He became head of NASA in 2015, while Boone became captain of the space station. Chalmers and Boone together rode the Mars Apollo project through the American government, and after Boone made the first landing in 2020, they both joined the first 100 and went to Mars in 2027. Maya stared at the clear black letters of the Roman alphabet. The pop articles with their one-liners and exclamation points had their suggestive moments, no doubt about it. A motherless boy with a father who drank, a hard-working, idealistic youth riding high and then losing a job and a marriage in the same year. That 2005 would be worth looking into in more detail. After that, he seemed pretty clearly in it for himself. That was what being an astronaut generally meant in NASA or Glovkosmos. Always trying to get more space time, doing administration to get the power to get out more often. By that time in his life, the brief descriptions chimed with the Frank she had known. No, it was the youth, the childhood. It was hard to see that, hard to imagine it as Frank. She called up the index again and ran down the list of biographical materials. There was an article called Broken Promises, Frank Chalmers and the National Service Corps. Maya tapped out the calling code for it and the text appeared. She scrolled down until she saw his name. Like many with basic structural problems in their lives, Chalmers coped in his Pensacola years by filling the days with ceaseless activity. If he had no time to rest, then he had no time to think. This had been a successful strategy for him all the way back to high school, when, in addition to all his school activities, he had worked 20 hours a week in a literacy program. And in Boston, his academic load made him what one classmate called an invisible man. We know less about this period of his life than any other. There are reports that he lived out of his car through his first Boston winter, using the bathrooms of a gym on campus. Only when he had secured the transfer to MIT do we have an address for him. Maya hit fast forward. Click, click. The Florida Panhandle was one of the poorest areas of the nation at the beginning of the 21st century, with Caribbean immigration, the closure of the local military bases, and Hurricane Dale combining to cause great misery. "You felt like you were working in Africa," one National Service Corps worker said. In his 3 years there, we get our fullest view of Chalmers as a social creature, as he secured grants to expand a jobs program that made an immense impact on the entire coast, helping thousands who had moved into makeshift shelters after Dale. Training programs taught people to build their homes, meanwhile learning skills that could be put to use elsewhere. The programs were immensely popular among the recipients, but there was opposition to them from the local development industry. Chalmers was therefore controversial, and in the first years of the new century, he appears often in the local media, enthusiastically defending the program and advocating it as part of a mass surge of grassroots social action. In a guest editorial for the Fort Walton Beach Journal, he wrote, "The obvious solution is to turn all our energies on the problem and work on it as a systemic thing. We need to build schools to teach our children to read and send them off to become doctors to heal us and lawyers to work the powers that be so we get our fair share. We need to build our own homes and our own farms and feed ourselves." The results in Pensacola and Fort Walton Beach got the local NSC larger grants from Washington and matching grants from participating corporations. At the high point in 2004, the Pensacola Coast NSC employed 20,000 people and was one of the main factors responsible for what was called the Gulf Renaissance.
Chalmers's marriage to Priscilla Jones, daughter of one of the old money families from Panama City, seemed to symbolize this new synthesis of poverty and privilege in Florida, and the two were a prominent couple in the society of the Gulf Coast for about 2 years. The election of 2004 ended this period. The abrupt cancellation of the NSC was one of the new administration's first acts. Chalmers spent 2 months in Washington testifying before House and Senate subcommittees, trying to aid the passage of a bill reinstating the program. The bill passed, but the two Democratic Florida senators and the congressman from the Pensacola district did not support it, and Congress was unable to override the executive veto. The NSC threatened market forces, the new administration said, and so it came to an end. The indictment and conviction of 19 congressmen, including Pensacola's representative, for lobbying irregularities originating in the building industry came 8 years later, and by that time the NSC was a dead issue, its veterans scattered. For Frank Chalmers, it was a watershed. He retreated into a privacy from which, in many respects, he never emerged. The marriage did not survive the move to Huntsville, and Priscilla soon remarried a friend of the family she had known before Chalmers's arrival in the area. In Washington, Chalmers led an austere life in which NASA appeared to be his exclusive interest. He was famous for his 18-hour days and the enormous impact they had on NASA's fortunes. These successes made Chalmers nationally famous, but no one at NASA or elsewhere in Washington claimed to know him well. The obsessive overscheduling served again as a mask behind which the idealistic social worker of the Gulf Coast disappeared for good. A disturbance at the front of the car caused Maya to look up. The Japanese were standing, pulling down luggage, and it was clear now that they were Burroughs natives. Most of them were about 2 meters tall, gangly kids with toothy laughs and uniformly brilliant black hair. Gravity, diet, whatever it was, people born on Mars grew tall. This group of Japanese reminded Maya of the ectogenes in zygote, those strange kids who had grown like weeds. Now scattered over the planet, that whole little world gone, like all the others before it. Maya grimaced, and on an impulse fast-forwarded her lectern to the article's illustrations. There she found a photo of Frank at age 23 in the beginning of his work with the NSC, a dark-haired kid with a sharp, confident smile, looking at the world as if he were ready to tell it something it didn't know. So young. So young and so knowing. At first glance, Maya thought it was the innocence of youth to look so knowing, but in fact the face didn't look innocent. His had not been an innocent childhood. But he was a fighter, and he had found his method and was prevailing, a power that couldn't be beaten, or so the smile seemed to say. But kick the world, break your foot, as they said in Kamchatka. The train slowed and glided to a smooth stop. They were in Fournier Station, where the Sabishi branch met the main Burroughs to Hellas piste. The Burroughs Japanese filed out of the car, and Maya clicked off her lectern and followed. The station was only a small tent south of Fournier Crater. Its interior was simple, a T-shaped dome. Scores of people wandered the three levels of the interior, in groups or singly, most of them in plain work jumpers, but many in business suits or metanational uniforms, or in casual clothes, which these days consisted of loose pantaloons, blouses, and moccasins. Maya found the sight of so many people a bit alarming, and she moved awkwardly past the kiosk lines and the crowded cafes fronting the pistes. No one met the eye of such a bald, withered androgyne. Feeling the artificial breeze on her scalp, she took her place at the front of the line to get on the next train south, turning over in her mind the photo from the book. Had they ever really been that young? At 1 o'clock, the train floated in from the north. Security guards came out of a room by the cafes, and under their bored eye, she put her wrist to a portable checker and boarded. A new procedure, and simple, but as she found a seat, her heart was racing. Clearly, the Sabbatians, with the help of the Swiss, had beaten the transitional authorities' new security system. But still, she had reason to be afraid. She was Maya Toitovna, one of the most famous women in history, one of the most wanted criminals on Mars, with the passengers in their seats looking up at her as she passed down the aisle, naked under a blue cotton jumper. Naked, but invisible, by reason of unsightliness. And the truth was that at least half the occupants of the car looked as old as her. Mars vets who looked 70 and could have been twice that, wrinkled, gray-haired, balding, irradiated and bespectacled, scattered among all the tall, fresh young natives like autumn leaves among evergreens. And there among them, what looked like Spencer Jackson. As she flung her bag onto the overhead rack, she looked at the seat three ahead. The man's bald pate told her little, but she was pretty sure it was him. Bad luck. On general principle, the first 100, the first 39, tried never to travel together. But there was always the chance that chance itself would screw them up. She sat in the window seat, wondering what Spencer was doing. Last she had heard, he and Sachs had formed a technological team in Vishniak Mohol doing weapons research that they weren't telling anyone else about, or so Vlad had said. So he was part of Sachs's crazy outlaw Eketage team, at least to some extent. It didn't seem like him, and she wondered if he had been the moderating influence one recently noticed in Sachs's activities. Was Hellas his destination? Or was he returning to the southern sanctuaries? Well, she wouldn't find out until Hellas at best, as the protocol was to ignore each other until they were in private. So she ignored Spencer, if it was him, and she ignored the passengers still filing into the car. The seat next to her remained empty. Across from her were 2 50-ish men in suits, emigrants by the look of them, apparently traveling with the 2 just like them who were seated in front of her. As the train pulled out of the station tent, they discussed some game they had all played together.
He hit it a mile. He was lucky to ever find it again.
Golf, apparently. Americans, or something like that. Metanational executives off to oversee something in Hellas. They didn't mention what. Maya took out her lectern and headphones and put the headphones on. She called up Novi Pravda and watched the tiny images from Moscow. It was hard to concentrate on the voices, and it made her drowsy. The train flew south. The reporter was deploring the growing conflict between Armscor and Subarashi over the terms of the Siberian Development Plan. This was a case of crocodile tears, as the Russian government had been hoping for years to play the 2 giants off against each other and create an auction situation for the Siberian oil fields rather than be met by a united Metanat front dictating all terms. It was surprising, in fact, that the 2 Metanats had broken ranks like this. Maya did not expect that it would last. It was in the Metanats' interest to hold together, to make sure it was always a matter of parceling out the available resources and never fighting for them. If they squabbled, the fragile balance of power might collapse on them, a possibility of which they were surely aware. She put her head back drowsily and looked out the window at the passing land. Now they were gliding down into the Iapygia Sink and had a long view to the southwest. It looked like the Siberian taiga-tundra border, as depicted on the news program she had just been watching. A great frost-fractured jumble of a slope, all caked with snow and ice, the bare rock coated with lichen and amorphous mounds of olive and khaki mosses, the coral cacti and dwarf trees filling every low hollow. Pingos dotting one flat low valley looked like a rash of acne smeared with a dirty ointment. Maya dozed for a while. The image of Frank at 23 jerked her awake. She thought drowsily about what she had read, trying to piece it together. The father, what had made him join Alcoholics Anonymous 3 times and quit it twice, or 3 times? It had a bad sound. And after that, as if in response to it, the kind of workaholic habits that were just like the Frank she had known, even if the work seemed unfrankishly idealistic. Social justice was not something that the Frank she had known had believed in. He had been a political pessimist, engaged in a constant rearguard action to keep the worse from coming to the worst. A career of damage control, and, if some were to be believed, personal aggrandizement. No doubt true, although Maya felt he had always craved power in order to effect more damage control. But no one could tease the strands of those two motives apart. They were tangled like the moss and the rock out there in the sink. Power was a many-faceted thing. If only Frank hadn't killed John. She stared at the lectern, turned it on, tapped in John's name. The bibliography was endless. She checked. 5,146 entries. And it was a selected list. Frank had several hundred at most. She switched to index mode and looked up death of. Scores of entries, hundreds. Cold and yet sweating, Maya ran swiftly down the list. The Byrne Connection, the Muslim Brotherhood, Mars First, Unoma, Frank, Her, Helmut Bronsky, Sachs, Samantha. By title alone, she could see that all theories of agency in his death would be advocated. Of course. Conspiracy theory was tremendously popular, always and forever. People wanted such catastrophes to mean something more than mere individual madness, and so the hunt was on. Disgust at the crackpot inclusiveness of the list almost caused her to shut the file, but then again, perhaps she was just afraid? She opened one of the many biographies, and there on the screen was a photo of John. A ghost of her old pain passed through her, leaving a kind of bleached, emotionless desolation. She clicked to the final chapter. The Nicosia riot was an early manifestation of the tensions in forming Martian society, which would later explode in 2061. There were already a great number of Arab technicians living in minimal housing arrangements in close proximity to ethnic groups with whom they had historical grievances, also to administration personnel whose better housing and travel and worker privileges were obvious. A volatile mix of several groups descended on Nicosia for its dedicatory celebration, and for several days the town was extremely crowded. Click, click. The violence has never been satisfactorily explained. Jensen's theory that the intra-Arab conflict, stimulated by the Lebanese War of Liberation from Syria, sparked the Nicosia riot, is insufficient. There were also documented attacks on the Swiss, as well as a high level of random violence, all impossible to explain in terms of the Arab conflict alone. The official depositions of the people in Nicosia that night still leave the ignition of the conflict a mystery. A number of reports suggest the presence of an agent provocateur never identified. Click, click. At midnight, when the time slip began, Saxifrage Russell was at a cafe midtown. Samantha Hoyle was on a tour of the city wall, and Frank Chalmers and Maya Toitovna had met in the Western Park where the speeches had been given a few hours before. Fighting had already broken out in the Medina. John Boone went down the central boulevard to investigate the disturbance, as did Sax Russell from another direction. At approximately 10 minutes into the time slip, Boone was set upon by a group of between 3 and 6 young men, sometimes identified as Arab. Boone was knocked down and whisked into the Medina before any witnesses could react, and an impromptu search turned up no sign of him. It was not until 12:27 a.m. that he was located by a larger search party in the town's farm and taken from there to the nearest hospital on Boulevard of the Cypresses. Russell, Chalmers, and Toitovna helped to carry him. Again, a disturbance in the car drew Maya out of the text. Her skin was clammy and she was shivering slightly. Some memories never really went away, no matter how you suppress them. Despite herself, Maya remembered perfectly the glass on the street, a figure on its back on the grass, the puzzled look on Frank's face, the so different puzzlement on John's. But those were officials there at the front of the car, standing in the aisle and moving slowly down it, checking IDs, travel documentation, and there were another two stationed at the back of the car. Maya tapped off her lectern. She watched the three policemen move down the car, feeling her pulse knocking hard through her body. This was new. She had never seen it before, and it seemed the others on board hadn't either. The car was hushed. Everyone watched. Anyone in the car could have had irregular ID, and that fact made for a kind of solidarity in their silence. All eyes focused on the police. No one looked around to see who might be blanching. The three policemen were oblivious to this observation, and almost seemed oblivious to the very people they interviewed. They joked among themselves as they discussed the restaurants of Odessa, and they moved from row to row rapidly, like conductors, gesturing for people to put their wrists up to the little reader, then cursorily checking the results, comparing for only a few seconds people's faces to the photos called up by their IDs. They came to Spencer, and Maya's heart rate picked up. Spencer, if it was Spencer, merely held up a steady hand to the reader, apparently looking straight at the seat back in front of him. Suddenly, something about his hand was deeply familiar. There, under the veins and the liver spots, was Spencer Jackson, no doubt of it. She knew it by the bones. He was answering a question now in a low voice. The policeman with the voice and eye reader held it to Spencer's face briefly, and then they all waited. Finally, they got a quick line on the reader and moved on. Two away from Maya. Even the exuberant businessmen were subdued, eyeing each other with sardonic grimaces and raised eyebrows, as if it were ludicrous to have such measures imported into the cars themselves. No one liked this. It was a mistake to do it. Maya took heart from that and looked out the window. They were ascending the southern side of the sink, the train gliding up the gentle grade of the piste over low hills, each higher than the next, the train always moving at the same speed as if moving by magic carpet over the even more magic carpet of the Mille Fleurs landscape. They stood over her. The one closest wore a belt over his rust uniform jumper, with several instruments hanging from the belt, including a stun gun. ID wrist, please. He wore an ID tag with photo and dosimeter and a label that said United Nations Transitional Authority. A thin-faced young emigrant of about 25, though it was easier to guess that from the photo than the face itself, which looked tired. The man turned and said to the woman officer behind him, "I like the veal parmesan they do there." The reader was warm on her wrist. The woman officer was observing her closely. Maya ignored the look and stared at her wrist, wishing she had a weapon. Then she was looking into the camera eye of the voice and eye reader. "What is your destination?" the young man asked. "Odessa." A moment's suspended silence. Then a high beep. "Enjoy your stay." And they were off. Maya tried to regulate her breathing to slow it down. The wrist readers took pulses, and if you were over 110 or so, they notified the applicator. It was a basic lie detector in that sense. Apparently, she had stayed under the line, but her voice, her retinas, those had never been changed. The Swiss passport identity must be powerful indeed, overriding the earlier IDs when they were consulted, at least in this security system. Had the Swiss done that, or the Sabichians, or Coyote, or Sachs, or some force she didn't know? Had she actually been successfully identified and let go, to be tracked so that she would lead them to more of the Fugitive Hundred? It seemed as likely as the idea of overmastering the big data banks, as likely or more. But for the moment she was left alone. The police were gone. Maya's finger knocked on the lectern, and without thinking about it, she called back what she had been reading. Michelle was right. She felt tough and hard, diving back into this stuff. Theories to explain the death of John Boone. John had been killed, and now she was being checked by police while traveling over Mars in an ordinary train. It was hard not to feel that there was some sort of cause and effect there, that if John had lived, it wouldn't be this way.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 14 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 15.